Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
I tell you what, a lot of people who would previously have said they don't like cricket have changed their mind, at least for this week. It's the Inside Edge on Love Sport Radio with the Cricketer magazine. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Sam Morshead, digital editor of the Cricketer. Sam, thanks for coming in. Lovely to be joined by you. You were there on a sensational, historical day for English cricket. What was it like?
It was extraordinary, actually, Johnny. It was like nothing that I've ever been a part of in a press box for just about any sport throughout my career. It was just an undulating piece of theatre that just was evolving before your very eyes, and you're going to have to adapt to it. And as a reporter, you're there, as you said earlier, as a cricket fan, but you're also there as someone who is employed to do a job, and you're employed to write about what's going on in front of you. And the demands of the internet are such that you have to provide something pretty quickly as soon as the game is finished. And trying to create a match report that drops on the final whistle, so to speak, for a game that had so many bends in the last hour, it was something, it's an experience that I will never forget, not only for what was happening out on the pitch, but was happening on my laptop as well.
Well, whatever sport you're watching, England never make it easy for us as fans. I would ask, was it ever in doubt? But it absolutely was. Was there a point there where you were trying to reconcile yourself to the fact that England weren't going to win this game?
Yeah, it took until Stokes needed 15 off 4 for me to be saying, okay, it's over. That was a part. I've been such a strong cheerleader of this team to win the World Cup throughout, even when they had their little dip in the group stages, that I wasn't about to throw it all away up until the very last point that it seemed possible, and that was 15 off 4. Because at that point, you know, he's got to hit the boundary twice in four balls against Trent Bolt, who's banging in his Yorkers, and it just felt like it was impossible. And then he picks that one out over mid-wicket, which is quite amazing the way he rotates his front foot to be able to get enough elevation on the ball. And then obviously we have the most surreal, most bitterly unfair, cruelest moment of sport that I've ever seen, which was the four overthrows, which got England to a position where they could force a super over.
It's absolutely incredible, because the phrase overthrow even is a bit unfair in that context, because he didn't even throw it that hard. It's just the Stokes dive and all of the drama that comes with it. Of course, Stokes doesn't even have the option there, does he, of not taking the runs. The umpire simply has to give them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a very unfortunate quirk of fate that's the situation that arose. And, you know, there's been some chat from players who would know, people who know Stokes. I think Jimmy Anderson spoke about it, quoting Michael Vaughan, saying that Stokes had actually asked for the umpires not to give those four runs in the moment, which you might say is a little bit of an exaggeration, and maybe that conversation did or didn't happen. Depends on whether you believe everything Michael Vaughan is saying.
I believe anything Michael Vaughan says.
That's another matter. But if he did, that would it would suggest something about Stokes's character, that he wanted to do it by right and not by fluke, which was exactly what it was. Those four runs were a complete fluke.
That is an amazing thing to ask, he must have known. I mean, there are two ways of looking at this. One is that Ben Stokes is so spectacularly confident in his own ability that he still backed himself to hit consecutive sixes or whatever it was he would have then needed. Or do you genuinely think that he cares more about being a good sportsman and doing it in the right way than he does winning the World Cup?
No, these guys are elite sportsmen. They care about winning. That's what they've spent their whole life training to do. That's what they put all of that sacrifice in, is to win that World Cup. It's been a 4-year journey literally focused on that one game.
Especially for Stokes,
given what happened a couple of years ago. So no, I don't believe that he would be doing it for the good of the game, but I can also understand why he might have said it in the moment, even as a way of appeasing New Zealand, who played the game in such a good way. They're brilliant examples for the sport and for their country, and maybe it was just a feeling that game was played in just the perfect way, in the perfect atmosphere, and it was such a good advert for cricket that he wanted it to finish fairly, and it did feel that there was an element of unfairness in what happened there.
I am always baffled, by the way, by the hyper competitiveness of elite sportsmen, because you know they have to be competitive and they have to really care about winning. But growing up, I thought I was quite a competitive bloke. You know, I'd sulk if I lost lost at Monopoly and all of this. And then I came and worked here and I started meeting ex-Premier League footballers, and you'll do stuff like a jokey quiz and they'll lose. And it's a problem. Like, it's a real problem. It's just this mindset, which I will never have, that it clearly is what you need to win a World Cup. England have got it. But as you suggested earlier, there were points in this tournament where, for those of us who were less faithful than you, it did look wobbly. Those losses to Sri Lanka and Australia. With that in mind, the fact that England came back from the brink to reach a final, if they lost it, would it have been even more heartbreaking?
I think losing in a final is probably more heartbreaking, but it would have felt more excusable than if they'd been knocked out in the group stages. You know, everyone expected them to go deep. Lots of people have that old English mentality where they never really believe that a team from this country is going to go all the way and win it. In fact, they probably would have been lovable fools if they'd gone and lost the final in such a tight way. People would have appreciated them. I think it's a bit different if you got knocked out in the group stages of your home World Cup after 4 years of hype. I mean, that would be so typically English that there would be a lot of gallows humour about that. But I think the criticism would have been pretty harsh if that had happened. Thankfully, it didn't.
And the atmosphere, I can't even imagine. What was it like?
Well, it's funny because in the Lords press box, we're not out in the open. It's, you know, as
behind the glass,
called the big spaceship, Sherry Blair's mouth, whatever you want to call it. it's up at one end, opposite the pavilion. It doesn't have any open windows for the written press, so they funnel the sound in through speakers. So microphones drop from underneath the press box and they pick up the
Star Trek sound.
Yeah, it's very similar. Look, you know, there's a music video, and I've forgotten the band that did it, but you have to look it up somewhere. A music video that was filmed in there that was pretending it was an alien spaceship. It was in the early noughties. I can't remember. Maybe during the news, I'll see if I can dig it out and find it for you. But anyway, I completely lost my track. But they're, because of those microphones, you hear it. But it's sort of a little bit muffled, and you've also got TVs playing, and they're playing at a different time because they've got the slight delay, so the atmosphere is a little bit warped in there. But what you could tell the difference is just the noise, the volume. You know, Lords is known for its hum. The Lords hum is something that you expect a few champagne corks popping at 11 o'clock on a Thursday morning at the start of a test match. This was just different. It was a hum, and then during the course of the afternoon it became a buzz, and then in that last 2 hours that buzz was a roar. And I've never heard a roar at Lords, and it's not something you associate with Lords. And actually, it's not something that's really done at Lords either. There's sort of this etiquette that you must behave yourself and, you know, dress up and be polite and be quiet and just watch the cricket.
So did we see, even with all respect, the sort of older members of the MCC with their lovely yellow and red ties, were even they roaring and doing the full football club limbs?
Well,
at the end?
I presume so. I mean, I've seen the videos that have come out, and there's been some brilliant stuff from the ICC.
There was that woman who jumps about. Have you seen this? For anyone who hasn't seen this, there's a woman standing about six rows back in a brown top, and England win the World Cup, and she just goes. I don't know where she landed. I hope she's okay, but she flew.
Amazing, isn't it? And that's what the emotion of real sporting drama can do to people who might usually not be anything like that. And that's what was so fantastic about that particular game, because it was true drama that everyone could immerse themselves in. And I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but so could 8.3 million people on television as well. And that made it even better.
And it was so accessible, despite the fact that the nature of a super over, which we'll talk about in a moment, is bizarre. I was watching it with my girlfriend, who's not a big cricket fan, and there was the tie, and she said, "What happens?" And I was thinking, hang on a minute, what does happen? A super over. Right, what's a super over? But in a funny way, it didn't really matter. Even if you're not an expert, you understand the premise, and suddenly it's like the tensest version of a penalty shootout you could possibly conceive of.
It's fascinating. I tell you, we got a bit of PR through from a company dealing in Google Trends, who's told us that the search term super over was 700,000% up at that
well, that's
point.
Because only three people had ever searched it in the
exactly.
past.
Exactly. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Because people don't really know. We didn't know about the boundary countback. The whole press box was trying to figure out, is there a...
And when you guys don't know.
No one's come across it. No one thinks it's ever going to happen. The rule's always been there. It's been written, or it's been slightly adjusted in time. But it's always been there, but no one checks it because no one thinks it's going to go there. I mean, it's just ludicrous.
And talking of things that are ludicrous, spare a thought for you and your colleagues in that press box, because it's dramatic enough for us at home watching, thinking, will England win? Will New Zealand win? But we're not having to rewrite our headlines. You were a man who was operating to very tight deadlines. How did you manage that?
Well, I had 4 match report intros that I wrote in the space of about an hour and a quarter.
Did one just begin with expletive?
Yeah, in my head, maybe. And they changed and they got tinkered with and they got binned. And actually, we published one of them on our website in the aftermath of it, the one that would have been if England had lost inside 50 overs.
That's cool.
Which is a very different atmosphere to a very different feel to the top 500 words of a report. But that had to be hastily binned. But it's a sort of good explanation from our point of view of what we're having to do to try and convey what is happening and in such a short time
frame. And get that tone as well and the change of tone in such fine margins.
Yeah, I mean, people will have a look and say, well, does it really need to change that much? Because there is one top, the one when they lost was a story of how it had been so close, and does that constitute failure for this England team and for the ECB over this four-year plan, given they're throwing away 50 over cricket effectively after this year? And then suddenly it becomes this joyful celebration of a brilliant team, and you think, well, the difference of that is Stokes's dive and the ball hitting it, and that can be the difference between a report that's talking about failure or questioning whether it's failure and a report about celebration. And that's just the amazing way that sport has the capability of telling different stories and changing that story so quickly.
Do you think it's odd that for all of the superb talent, the genius of that England squad, the incredible performance of Stokes, the moment that we're going to look back on as one of the greatest in English cricketing history isn't a piece of skill, it's a total accident?
Yes, and it's a controversy and it's a blurred area in the laws, but what was 66, hey? I mean, there was a Russian linesman who decided one thing when other people thought it was another.
And they had hand of God as well, so we got to get something.
There's all sorts of things. This is what happens. It was unfair and it's horribly cruel on New Zealand. But sport does deal this up. If it had been the other way around, I'm sure we wouldn't have taken it as well as New Zealand have.
No,
that's for sure.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not at all. As a final note on the atmosphere, you were mentioning that roaring in Lords isn't something that's broadly expected, and this is for the fans sitting out in the ground itself. What was the atmosphere like in the press box? Because you guys are, of course, huge cricket fans, but you are also at work. Mm. So was there cheering? Was there jumping into each other's arms? Was there champagne? What was going on? Or was it, hang on, I've got a deadline?
There was a lot of astonishment and hands on heads and mouths, particularly, again, around that Stokes incident. There was some cheering at the end. I think there's usually an unwritten rule, a constitution, a convention, more like it, in press boxes that you don't, well, particularly in England, it's a bit different in other press boxes, but in England,
where they actually have fun.
Yeah, maybe. But we're all stiff upper lip and do it very
yes,
proper.
Quite, so. As we should.
But that we don't cheer and that you try and retain some element of impartiality while
Did
you're
you
at
not
work.
Cheer?
At the very end, yes, I think I might have done. I might have punched the air. I'm not entirely sure, but there was some cheering. There was some that were just, you've got to work. You've got to file a report. There's time for really celebrating later. To be honest, I didn't really watch it as you would watch it as a fan, as you'd be totally immersed by it.
Yeah.
You don't quite get to do that as a reporter because you've got to have a laptop going and you've got to be thinking about themes and you've got to be thinking about adjectives and you've got to be thinking about turns of phrase. And you can't be investing purely in the drama that's in front of you because then you wouldn't be working and then you wouldn't have a report to file and then you'd get fired. So that's a real problem.
High stakes for everyone, yeah, not just Stokes.
It is tricky to be able to fully immerse yourself. So I've actually only really seen it in those clips again back, you know, the ones that have been shared millions of times online. I've yet to watch the highlights, which I need to because I want to watch.
Would you
the
watch
game.
The whole thing back?
I'm not sure my wife would let me.
Well, we'll focus on the key moments then, just to keep her happy. Coming up, let's talk about the most super of super overs.
Love Sport.
It's the Inside Edge with the Cricketer magazine here on Love Sport Radio. You're with me, Johnny Burrow, and Sam Morshead, digital editor of the Cricketer. And Sam, I need you to clear the rules up for me, frankly, because you're an expert. We saw how many runs that Stokes got given for that accidental dive and the overthrow. But there are other people saying England should only have got 5 runs. What is the letter of the law here?
They should only have got 5 runs.
So what we're saying is that New Zealand should have won the World Cup.
You could say that. England would have needed 4 off 2 with Adil Rashid on strike. So it could still have been possible. 3 off 2 for a super over. So, I know.
But you can't go back, can you?
And you this can't is
the
go thing. Back.
No. Any sporting decision, he gets it wrong.
No.
It would be different if it were the final ball and England had done it by a run. But actually, if you were a Kiwi, though, would you be feeling a bit hard done by?
Only when I was told that it should have been five, because if I was playing in that game, if that game had been a club
Two
cricket match,
to be thinking about
well,
it.
I just, no, but in any game that I've ever played, I would have expected it to be six, because the batsmen across, they gone, well, they crossed when the overthrow per se had gone and happened, but the actual act is when it's released from the fielder's hand. And at the point that Martin Guptill released it, Adil Rashid and Ben Stokes hadn't crossed for their second run. Therefore, it should have been one. Stokes should have gone back to the end from whence he came, which would have been the non-striker's end. But if it had happened in a game that I was playing in up until Sunday, I would have thought it would have been six.
Whereas so, now, if it happens, you'll be right in the umpire's face.
Well, look, we've seen a sudden spate of man-cadding in youth team cricket after what's happened in the IPL recently. So I wonder whether we're going to start seeing a spate of young cricketers suddenly getting very, very au fait with the rules.
Well, this is the thing, that the margins are so fine that actually if the difference between victory and defeat is being a real, real nerd about subclause 8.2, then actually there's value in that.
Yeah, absolutely. And why not know the rules of the game you're playing?
Call me old-fashioned.
That would be good. That would be good. I think that's one of the brilliant things about cricket, and that's one of the very funny things about people who would have been watching with people identifying themselves as cricket experts on Sunday, and they're watching for the first time, because they would have turned to the people who identify as cricket experts and asked what's going on. And there is no way that any of us could say, oh, this is what's happening, and this is what's happening, and this is what's happening. You couldn't. It was just completely up in the air. It was a big ball of nothingness and everything. No one really knew what was happening.
It'd be quite cool, though, wouldn't it? I mean, if I had a time machine, I'd quite like to go back just so I could smugly turn to my friends and go, well, you see, if they'd crossed on that second run, it would have been six runs, but really it should be five. You could look really very clever indeed. A bit of luck, and the margins were fine, not just in terms of the rules, because there was also what could have been a wicket and ended up being six runs.
I know, amazing. And what a sort of reliving of a previous episode in the tournament for Trent Bolt, who of course caught Carlos Brathwaite on the boundary at Old Trafford when West Indies had taken a game from the jaws of defeat and were on the verge of victory there, and Bolt took the catch on the boundary, and another 2 feet it would have gone over. New Zealand would have lost that game. New Zealand had lost that game. They could have ended up not even being in the knockout stage. But it comes to the final and his bearings desert him a little bit. He could have chucked that ball up to Martin Guptill beside him. He'd done that many times. Trent Bolt is a fantastic outfielder. But for whatever reason, on that moment, he chose to step backwards when he took the catch. And yeah, that changes the game completely. That definitely. If he takes that, game over.
That's a huge, huge moment. I'll tell you what, it's lucky I wasn't in Lords, because there was a definite roar when that happened. But let's talk about the Super Over. And a huge decision for everyone involved to give that ball to Jofra Archer.
Yeah, it makes sense, though, because he is the death bowler in that team, the guy who's played the most T20 matches over the course of the past couple of years. He's played at high level. He's played for Hobart. He's played for Rajasthan. He knows what it takes to defend small targets in big innings. And he has a fantastic Yorker. It didn't work once in that over. Once in the whole over for a kid playing in his first World Cup. It's only his 14th ODI. It's a World Cup final. And he's pinging in these 90-mile-an-hour Yorkers to win his team the biggest prize in the sport. I think that shows remarkable control, self-belief, confidence. I mean, you wouldn't have thought it after the first ball, because he bowled a wide, the most marginal of wides that you'll ever see. And his shoulders sort of slumped for the first time in the competition. We're used to seeing this sort of strutting, confident chap. And he was walking back with his arms crossed. And it was at that point that his teammates come over and speak to him and give him a sort of jolly up. And
were you a bit worried? Because you get the first ball as a wide, and then he gets that G up from the teammates. The second ball goes for six. You then are thinking, Jofra, we know you're a fantastically talented bowler, but are you losing your nerve here, mate?
Yeah, when they are nine off two and they're chasing 16, then you back New Zealand at that point. And yes, there was worries, but boy, did Jimmy Neesham hit that cleanly, because that pitch was not easy to bat on. There was very few instances of the ball being timed on that strip, and he pinged it miles into the mound stand. It was only slightly off length from Archer, and Neesham cracked it into the into the crowd.
Is there a psychological aspect there for Archer in the sense that it's not just that he went for six, he went for six?
Yeah, he really did. And he came back from it, though. And that's what defines these bowlers. You know, he went for 15 in an over, but that was enough to win. So he knew that he could do that. And he pulled it right back. He protected those runs. He protected six or four balls, which is a fantastic effort.
It's a sensational performance, and it's a sensational story as well, because let's remember that for the past couple of years, there's been quite a lot of argument about this young man, with various idiots suggesting that because he's born in Bridgetown, Barbados, he potentially shouldn't be playing for England at all. He showed in all kinds of ways, on the pitch, off it, that he absolutely should be. But what a story to go from some people not wanting him involved to being the man to win it.
Yeah, I'm not sure who these people are that didn't want him involved. I'm not sure whether we've, as a media, over-egged it.
There was quite a lot of argument at the time.
There was a debate about it, but there hasn't been a debate for Jason Roy. You know, there hadn't been a debate for Owen Morgan. And these guys slotted in. The one strand of it was that he could be a disruption because they'd been together for 4 years, as in anyone could be a disruption at that point, which I guess I can sort of understand. But then you also would have to say, well, you haven't seen the guy bowl in the last 2 years because he's quite clearly deserving of a place in this England
side. Yeah, if Lionel Messi signs for City now, he could disrupt the squad. Well, yes, but there are some players you're willing to be disrupted by, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. And he proved that. And he's nailed down his spot in that England side and in other England sides for a very long time to come.
This is something we're going to talk about later in the show, but are we going to be looking at Jofra Archer in the Ashes as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure he's going to be fit enough to play in the first test, but yes, I mean, they'd be mad not to. How they balance what looks like a very, very good red ball attack is going to be interesting. But let's not forget that apart from T20 stuff, his real performances have been for Sussex in the County Championship, and he's been doing the business and doing damage for 3 years now in red ball cricket. So he's ready. And he can do it. And boy, will he be a threat to those Aussie top order.
Absolutely. And can I ask about his Twitter as well? I'm not sure if you've seen this. Basically, Jofra Archer is a younger man, 4 or 5 years ago, did a lot of tweeting, which now looks positively prophetic. He was back in time with tweets like, and I quote, "Oh, I'd love a super over." And Twitter was having quite a lot of fun with this. I mean, if you search Jofra Archer on Twitter, the first thing you get is a photo of him on his phone after the World Cup with the caption, "Jofra Archer now tweeting about the 2023 World Cup." Did the English fans show a World Cup winning level of humour as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, England were all prepared to fail, weren't they, the English fans? So preparing the jokes ahead of time. But with Archer, that just shows a guy who's in love with cricket and has been for a very long time. He's a kid who'd sit and watch it on the telly and tweet about guys who were effectively heroes of his. And he's playing with and against them and beating them and winning with them now. And that's just a beautiful story about someone who's applied himself, done everything that was asked of him and more, and has become a major role model, and I would say a cult hero now, and hopefully to many hundreds of thousands of young people who might have caught a glimpse of him on Sunday.
And a couple of choice Jofra Archer tweets for those of you listening at home. On the 5th of January 2014, Jofra tweeted, "Don't worry, England, I'm soon here." And on the 22nd of February 2014, he tweeted, "I'd fit right into that England pace attack." He wasn't wrong, was he? Quite something indeed. And we also have seen a bit of argument about the makeup of the squad more broadly. Jacob Rees-Mogg, who obviously is always a popular bloke, who I'm very, very keen on, immediately tweeted, "Oh, we don't need Europe for success." You think, right, well, you're a moron. But there was also the response of Owen Morgan to the question, "Was the luck of the Irish with you?" Where he said, "Listen, some of the lads were saying we had Allah on our side as well." How relevant is it that this is such a diverse England team?
I think it's relevant because it's representative of the country that they are representing. You know, it's an important part of our cultural fabric that we are multi-ethnic and that we come from very diverse backgrounds. And your teams that represent you on an international stage should reflect the values that we have as a society. And this team does and do. And Morgan is a leader that says the right things at the right times. And he knows how to bash back questions, which, to be honest, are completely unnecessary at that moment, and comments such as Mr. Rees-Mogg's as well. But look, it's a brilliant team made up of West Country lad and guys from the Northeast. A kid from Durban who came over when he was 10 years old, two devout Muslims, one whose dad was a cabbie, another one from Bradford, an Irishman, you know, a Dublin boy who's come over and made an England team his own. It's just absolutely packed full of people from all over the world, and that's multicultural Britain, and that is a brilliant thing that should be celebrated at a time when it seems in certain sectors people would rather it disappeared.
Just a quick reminder from Jacob Rees-Mogg that, of course, this was a purely English team and we don't need anyone else to succeed at any level in anything.
This is Love Sport.
It's Johnny Burrow and Sam Morshead here for the Inside Edge with the Cricketer magazine on Love Sport Radio. And we've got to talk about Ben Stokes. It wasn't a single-handed effort, but he did drag England to a first World Cup final win. It's quite a turnaround for a man who's had a spot of bother in the last couple of years.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about redemption. I'm not personally a believer that you redeem yourself on the pitch from your actions that took place off it. But he's certainly mellowed as a player, if that makes any kind of sense. The way in which he bats has changed. He's still the same character in the dressing room, obviously, but he seems to bring a different quality as a cricketer to the team since he's come back. And this World Cup, he was just simply sensational. He was England's most consistent batsman, the most reliable middle-order batsman. He was the man who pulled them out of a hole, who nearly got them past Sri Lanka when everyone else was losing their heads, who was the only person to stay firm against Australia when everyone else was imploding. And then in the final, he produces just a Herculean effort to pull England kicking and screaming into a super over. And then to still have the energy and the legs to go out and run three off the first ball and then find a gap for four, it is incredible what that man did at the World Cup. So I don't believe in redemption per se, but I certainly believe in superhuman cricketing performances, and that was him.
Absolutely. Do you think we're too quick as a society to forgive our sports people off-field errors for on-field brilliance? Do we short-circuit to going, well, you've won us a World Cup, so all is forgiven?
I think it's easy. I think it's also very easy for certain individuals to really focus in on their errors off the field, and they get it a lot more. I don't think there's an even balance. I don't think we treat all sportsmen equally when it comes to what they do off the pitch. But if you can look at a sportsman as just a sportsman and what they do on the field, then that's a better reflection of the performance than to try and incorporate a thrown punch in a Bristol street almost 2 years ago with yes. What happened at Lord's. That was a Ben Stokes on a night out, and a different, very different Ben Stokes.
Do you think it is a very different Ben Stokes in every way?
Not every way. No, I don't think every way. He's got to have the same sort of firebrand, just the raw competitiveness. And the sort of fire in the belly and the willingness to get involved in a scrap, even if it's not a literal scrap, that has to be part of an elite sportsman. As we talked about, they have to be born to win, and they have to have the drive to win. And it's important that he still has that. But I think that his performances have shown that he's a bit of a different cricketer now. You know, his strike rates have dropped, and he's more considered at the crease. He seems to be able to time an innings more and pace an innings and play an anchor role, which is really important because he's got a team of hitters around him.
There's been a lot of talk of Sir Ben Stokes, of a knighthood for this performance. And as we've said, it was a sensational cricketing performance. But do you think we should forgive errors made in Bristol streets when we're looking at who we make Knights of the Realm? Or should we perhaps keep them in the back of our mind?
Oh, I think that there's always should be the option of forgiving indiscretions like that. And I don't think that necessarily something like that should prevent someone from receiving a knighthood somewhere down the line. I just think it's just hopelessly premature for him to be given a knighthood.
Really?
Yeah.
So what would he have to do? He's won the World Cup. If he plays a significant role in an Ashes win this summer, then are we looking at Sir Ben?
Not for me, no.
But then I've got to go and do charity work.
Maybe. I was also of the opinion that Alistair Cook's was probably a little bit premature as well.
Do you think it was a bit sentimental?
Yeah, that's British society.
That's knighthoods, I suppose, isn't it?
It is sentimental. It's either sentimental or you've got to have a lot of money. That's literally...
or both.
I don't think that's going to be the case for cricketers. They have some money, but not enough to buy themselves a knighthood. Although this is going off to a horrible tangent. I'm going to stop before I accuse anyone of something.
No, that's I'm interested. I'm almost tempted to keep it going.
No, but I feel that, you know, if there's someone like Sir Ian Botham is both the player that he was on the pitch, and he's gone on to raise a huge amount of money for charity through his various walking initiatives. Another man who also had his off-field indiscretions, let's not forget, when he was a player. I think that you need to push that through longer in life than just Stokes.
You won the World Cup.
30
bang.
Years. Then, yeah. It doesn't. Yes, he's won the World Cup. That's absolutely fantastic. He should be honoured in some way, just as the Ashes team were honoured in 2005. But a Sir... Why give that to him so early? Should you have it later in life?
Well, there's part of me that wants a premature wave of English sporting knighthoods just so we can see what the next wave of leaked Beckham emails looks like. Ben Stokes before me. What are you on about? I would absolutely love it. I think you're right, actually. I think he should have to wait. He's, of course, made a good start towards getting there. And this whole team has made an incredible start towards making cricket a more popular and more accessible sport in this country. How big was it that final was on Channel 4?
Massive. When you look at the breakdown of the figures and how many people watched it on Sky channels and how many people watched it on free-to-air channels, and the argument is just over that if you put something on a free-to-air channel, it's going to get substantially more exposure. There is an argument around how much money needs to be generated by the ECB to go into funding, and Sky have obviously put in a huge amount of money into grassroots cricket and higher up, and they've played a massive role in the promotion of the sport throughout the country over the course of the last 15 years. But the argument should also be there needs to be an element of exposure for cricket to a wider audience to allow them to fall in love with the game that we all love. And for that to happen, some, not all, of cricket needs to be on free-to-air. We have the 100 coming in, which is going to be a dozen games on the BBC, we've got no guarantee that people are going to go and watch that. We obviously do have a guarantee that people are watching England in major matches. So why not put a couple of major matches a year on free-to-air? Not the whole lot. Not every Ashes.
Because your difficulty is the ones that people want to watch are by definition the most valuable as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There is obviously a degree of compromise that needs to be struck here, and it has to be a balance between people's wages, people's pockets, company making money, and the willingness to grow the sport. And that's where, for me, the breakdown happens, is how willing they are to compromise. Sky showed tremendous, tremendous spirit in allowing Channel 4 to take that simulcast.
It was quite a good little PR spin as well.
It was a good PR spin, but it's an incredibly generous gesture. You see the figures that Channel 4 have generated out of it. It's massive TV. Massive TV. If that Wimbledon final hadn't been taking place at the same time, those figures would probably have been another 4 million higher, maybe even more. So it shows that the appetite remains there. If you have visibility and success, you'll get growth. At the moment, we've got the success, and on that day, we had the visibility. We'll see growth. I mean, we're seeing it just at the Cricketer. We've seen 5 of the last 7 days, we've seen record traffic to our site, which is only about cricket. And that's people going and looking for cricket. More page views than we've ever had before because of success that people could see. And now they want to find out more about it.
There is also a sort of dormant cricketing audience out there. My dad grew up watching cricket the whole time because it was always on. He doesn't have Sky, so doesn't watch it. And then at the weekend, he sent me a photo of him with his feet up, with a beer, with the cricket on, going, oh, I've missed this. Why haven't I been watching cricket? So there are people who'll get into it. Obviously wonderful to see all these audiences grow. But was there a frustration there as a cricket journalist, as a cricket fan, to see a World Cup final have to compete with the Wimbledon final and, of course, with the British Grand Prix for viewing figures? Surely we can split them up.
Well, I mean, in theory, yes, it would be good if that was possible. That requires a lot of inter-governing body conversations, which I can't imagine would take place. They all want to have the pride of place, You know, Wimbledon is always the first 2 weeks of
July. Surely a World Cup final, though. Everyone's saying, oh, Wimbledon's all this tradition. It's a World Cup final. I'm not really interested.
But then you could say the same for a Football World Cup final also found itself on the same day.
Oh, no, come on. If it's coming home. If the football's coming home, then even the cricket, I'm sorry, Sam, has to...
But that's what I mean. Everyone has a different opinion of what should go where. And let's not forget that Wimbledon had an audience that was 2.5 times bigger than the cricket.
That's true. But surely we have to do this democratically, which means that if I want to see the football's on the telly.
Well, there we go.
That is how it works, right? I think. I'm not quite sure. Call in 0208 7020 558. We were hearing lots of reports of people with one screen was the cricket, one was the F1. They had the tennis on their phone. Can you juggle it in that way? Can you get that feeling of a World Cup final, the tension of a longest ever Wimbledon final when you're watching all three?
I don't think you can. I mean, I'm a bit biased with this because I don't really get F1. So I could quite easily have that not even on and be quite happy.
Well, it's quite straightforward. You turn it on, see that Hamilton's winning, turn it off again.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the problem, though, is because we can't be dismissive, too dismissive about... another sport like
it
that.
It was a great Grand Prix, by the way.
I didn't see any of it.
Absolutely fantastic.
But this is the problem that we would have as cricket fans dismissing another sport, because that's what F1 fans, well, many F1 fans would do with cricket. They say, it's dull, why are you watching
it? It's too long, why would you watch an entire day? A sport that takes a week, what are you doing?
Exactly. And that's, again, an element of compromise, you know, sharing each other's love for the sport and explaining why everything is great. And more people that get into more sports is better for the sporting world in general. But in answer to the original question, I don't think I could... properly emotionally invest myself in two iconic, seismic, dramatic pieces of sporting theatre that were on Sunday.
On that point of detractors from the sport, in this week where cricket's got a ludicrous amount of exposure, how would you respond to the people who still want to say it's too slow, it takes too long, the rules are too complicated? What's the defence?
Well, the rules probably are still. I don't think
was
we can
five
use
runs. Or?
I don't think we can use what happened on Sunday as a defence against complicated rules.
No, fair enough.
But if on the other point, if they were watching on Sunday and they still think that cricket is just dull, then there's no point pursuing them. Just let them be.
What if I said I could have turned that on for the last half hour and got most of the excitement?
I would say to that, you have no context. That's like reading the last chapter of a book and saying it was the best thing you've ever read.
What a twist. Yeah, no, I think that's fair enough. It sounds like your defences are well prepared. And with that, we are seeing a whole new wave of cricket fans be convinced by the excitement the sport can offer. What kind of legacy is this win going to leave?
It's quite hard to say for certain, because we don't know how the ECB are going to really jump in and nail it. Like, there's a competition going on right now, which started today, T20 Blast, which is obviously our version of the IPL or the Big Bash. And it is hugely popular in this country. And county cricket, in its T20 version, is hugely popular. And this should be an opportunity to make sure that every single ground for every single game of this competition, which lasts in various stages through until mid-September, is absolutely full. Because it's thrilling cricket, it's easily accessible, it's not horribly expensive, and a lot of counties, some don't, but a lot of counties do design their programmes around young families coming in to watch. Some, unfortunately, are still a bit of a Friday night booze up, which might be an issue that needs to be addressed to encourage these audiences to come in. So that's where they should be pushing it. Unfortunately, we don't see any real extra marketing boost in the last few days from the ECB for the Blast, whereas we've seen quite a lot of viral marketing for the 100 for next year. So that's the other legacy point that they can use. They've got a big plan called Inspiring Generations, which spreads itself over the next 5 years. It relates to the TV rights deal, but it also relates to a number of different areas across the sport from the grassroots up. And it's all very admirable. But in terms of headline grabbing, it's the 100 is what they're pinning their hopes on. They're sticking £200 million a year into it to make sure that it grows and it reaches people that before maybe didn't see cricket. But those are the kind of people who came out supporting Bangladesh, India and Pakistan at this World Cup. They come out to support their country, and they've got to find a way of encouraging these guys to come and support teams that currently don't exist in a competition that currently doesn't exist. And that's going to be really interesting. And if they manage to make it work, and they probably will because they've got so much money to put behind it, then we'll see whether that can progress. I think the real test, the acid test, will be in 10 years, have we got cricket back into PE syllabuses? Have we got more state school people playing sport? Have we got participation rates up between the ages of 11 and 18, where they've been falling off a cliff over the last decade or so? Have we got clubs not folding as they're doing at a remarkable rate at the minute out in the sticks? And have we been able to create an emotional tie between every corner of our country and the sport that really should be enjoyed by everyone?
It's a tough thing to do. Do you think that the potentially boozy element of watching cricket is a problem for the sport? Is it a positive for the sport? Because I still have my friends selling it to me and other people as, come to the cricket, you don't even have to watch the cricket, just get pissed.
So there's two ways of looking at it. One, yes, because I come from a point where I'm just as guilty as having gone and had beers, particularly with guys who aren't quite as interested, and it's been a catch-up. And maybe there's been occasion that we've had too many.
Surely
been
not,
a bit loud.
Sam. No. A responsible man like
no,
you.
I know. But that's the point there is that is a way of selling it, and you can sell out grounds doing that.
Because, and you can get people in who wouldn't be there to watch it.
And you can earn extra money through the sale of alcohol, which can up your revenues for counties which don't get a lot of money elsewhere. Then that can be a big deal. So, yes, that is a way of selling it. It's also quite a short-termist approach because it's already a guaranteed audience. And what isn't guaranteed are these other ethnic groups that would support Pakistan or Bangladesh or India, who come from
teetotal
or for religious reasons don't drink. There were big marked differences in the amount of alcohol sold at games involving all Asian nations compared to those involving non-Asian nations at the last World Cup. This World Cup, sorry. And that changes the way in which a county might go about structuring their profit loss plan for the year.
Yeah.
But if you get into those families and you can encourage them to turn out and they realise that this is a safe place to go and take their children.
Well, you don't have to be drinking beer.
You don't have to. There's no peer pressure. There's no loud strangers coming up and shouting obscenities over the shoulder. Even if they're not being particularly nasty, if that's just being a drunk English bloke. We know what we are when we're drunk white English
nightmares.
Blokes. We are awful. So we have to figure out how you can have a place for both, for guys and girls who want to go and have beers and pims and be merry, and where you've got other families who just want to go and be merry without all the other stuff. And there is a balance to be struck there. And I do think that it's that the blast has taken a little bit of too much of a turn towards the sort of Friday night booze fest. And we do have to be careful of what's happened in racing, which is a similar problem there in that it's taken up quite a lot of booziness over the last few years, and it's a growing reputation for incidents.
Fighting in the crowd, and all of that.
Which we don't want to see. And I'm sure racing doesn't want to see, and it's not the intended consequence of their marketing plan. So there needs to be a very healthy balance struck between the two. And if the ECB can do it and they can encourage these families who obviously want to come out and do it, these British-based families, 86% of tickets for this World Cup were sold to British citizens. So it's obvious these people are there and they love cricket. Just how are you getting them into the stadiums when it's not their national team? That's the question.
Well, there's going to be room for both this summer at the Ashes. Coming up, we'll be looking ahead and who could be in that squad. Don't go anywhere.
Love Sport.
You're listening to The Inside Edge here on Love Sport Radio. It's with the Cricketer magazine, and I am with Sam Morshead, who's digital editor of the magazine. And Sam, I hear the Cricketer have got a very special commemoration coming up for this World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously England won the World Cup. We are an English-based cricket magazine, though we do cater for the world as a whole. And we thought that it's only right that we commemorated a historic first men's World Cup victory with special covers. So for the first time in the Cricketer's 99-year history, we're producing 12 separate covers for the same edition, one with the team lifting the trophy, but the other 11 is one for each of the 11 men who played in that final on Sunday. So they'll be distributed around newsstands across the country, and you've got to catch them all Why don't you go and buy 12 different editions? So they're available in different outlets. Additionally to that, for those people who might just be falling in love with cricket or have rediscovered cricket because of what's happened over the course of the past 6 weeks, we've got a very special subscription offer, which is that you can sign up for 12 editions right now for just £20.19. Wow. You see what we did there?
Not bad at all.
Yeah, £20.19. And given that you can buy one off the shelf for £5.50, that equates to about 3¾ magazines. Magazines. So it's a really good deal.
Serious value.
Come and have a dip. See whether cricket is for you. Or if you know it is, but you're a bit lapsed, come and catch up. So anyway, you could go and visit our website, www.thecricketer.com, and there's signage there for what you need to do. Also on our social media, which is at The Cricketer Mag, you'll be able to find out all of the relevant information. But come and join us on Voyage Cricket as we go boldly forwards into the 21st century.
Well, quite. It all sounds wonderful. Voyage Cricket has gone quite a long way this summer. I know you've been a very busy man. You're not done yet, because we've got an Ashes series coming up, and England are going to be going into this not just having won the World Cup, but battered Australia in the semis as well. Spirits, confidence, going to be high.
Yeah, and a lot of the players that were in that white ball squad are going to be playing Test cricket too. So they'll take all of that experience with them into that first Test at Edgbaston, which is in 2 weeks. It's 2 weeks today. And there's a Test
match. Have a sleep. It's okay.
Test match against Ireland, which starts on Wednesday. This schedule is not catered for journalist sleep patterns, that's for sure. But yeah, the Ash is going to be brilliant. It always is. There's an element of theatre, even when it ends a little bit one-sided or a lot one-sided. There are always bigger storylines, and it always throws up really interesting conversations and talking points. So really looking forward to seeing what happens at Edgbaston on the 1st of August.
Exciting to look forward to. And on that Ireland test, Jason Roy has been included in a test squad for the first time. Do you think that's a good choice?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think it's unavoidable now. So there's been a lot of chat about it for a couple of years, but I think you can't get past it simply because of the way that he's been playing for the last year. He's not played a lot of Red Bull cricket in his Red Bull career. His stats aren't amazing. They're solid. He's not played a lot at the top of the order. He's been mostly used in the middle order by Surrey. They bumped him up to three last year at the end of the Championship season. The request of the ECB just to try and get him a little bit more against the new ball. So it'll be really interesting to see how he goes against a swinging Duke's ball, which is a very different proposition to a white Kookaburra and two white Kookaburras, which don't do anything like the same amount. So Josh Hazlewood, Pat Cummins, Mitchell Starc versus Jason Roy at the top of the order is going to be really fascinating.
And Jofra Archer, you're mentioning possibly not quite fully fit for that first test, but he's going to have a big role to play.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He's got a small left side strain. He's going off for a holiday in Barbados, which he absolutely deserves, and then in theory should be coming back fit to fire at Lords in the second week of August. And yeah, that's amazing, brilliant. Think of a new ball pairing of Archer and Jimmy Anderson, presuming that Jimmy's calf is okay as well.
How long's Jimmy got left in the tank? Because he's a fantastic bowler, but he's not a spring chicken.
I wouldn't know. You wouldn't want to guess. The guy seems to go on and on and on and on. You know, that you would think that he's approaching his last Ashes series.
Yeah.
You would think. But he's the kind of guy you don't just rule out on a whim, because he could come back and prove
you
wrong.
He could become a professional darts player, couldn't he? Anyway, by all accounts, isn't he meant to be absolutely brilliant?
I don't know for certain, but it wouldn't surprise me.
I think there are various sort of darts-themed places, shall we say, around London where they have a leaderboard, and apparently Jimmy Anderson is near the top or at the top of almost all of them. So he's a very, very talented guy. Listen, these things are famously hard to call, Sam, but if you had to make a prediction for the Ashes, who's going to win it? How comfortable is it going to be? Are we going to see any super overs?
We're not going to see any super overs. For all those new fans of cricket that have arrived since, there won't be a super over.
The rules are different.
I'm glad you gave me one question that I could give a definitive answer to.
No, I know the rules for this one.
I think it's going to be quite a lot closer than maybe we've had in the Ashes in the last few years. And I would expect it to be a really pulsating 6 weeks of cricket. Of course, I'm going to say that England are going to win it. But
do you believe that?
I don't believe it with the conviction that I believe they'd win the World Cup.
Okay.
But we'll see. We'll see how... Basically, it depends on how the Australians deal with the moving ball as much as it depends on how Jason Roy deals with the moving ball up front. But with Warner and Smith back in that team, it's a fairly formidable top order. So we'll see.
Well, England are in about as high spirits as they could be going into it. We're confident. Cricket's come home. It's going to come home again later in the summer. And Sam Morshead, digital editor of The Cricketer, it's been a pleasure to be in your company. You're going home because you're finally getting a breather. So have a break. The cricket will be back, as will you. It's been a pleasure to have you and your colleagues in the Love Sport studio this summer. Thank you.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.